Welcome to the Think It Isn't Until It Is podcast. I'm Finn.
I'm Tim.
I'm Guy.
So, chapter 9, 2015, Into the Unknown. This chapter's entitled, What Else? What Else, Buddy? In which we reflect on...
An ellipsis, a mystifying ellipsis. Just a general sort of overview of like now we'd reached this kind of place where we were, I think you put it, we were that band.
A band
who are on a, and there's a lot of discussion about the fact that we're on an indie label and how good it is to be on an indie label.
Yeah. We are an independent band. We were always on an indie and then... We started Recouped so that we were an independent band underneath the umbrella of an independent label on an independent distributor. And yeah, sometimes being independent is a choice. Sometimes it is your only choice.
Yeah.
But I suppose being on an independent allowed us to make this arc, to go from bedroom demo to the 2015 kind of, touring plateau of, you know, we were that band. We were selling out venues in Europe and we were touring a lot. And the record was a hit with a small H, I suppose. And I think one of the things I talk about in the last chapter of the book, I suppose, is that if I had signed to a major or something back in the day, I remember the first gig I did at Plastic People in London acoustically, I got approached. This is before we just put out Pretty Little Thing. I got approached by two majors immediately at that gig. Both saying, hey, have you got a deal? Obviously in an English accent, but, you know, we'd love to give you a deal. And are you signed? And I was kind of like, yeah, I'm signed, actually. So, you know, no probs. We wouldn't have got this far. We would have probably released two records and been probably dropped very slowly and messily. And as I also say in the book, we were already too old when we started to be signed to a major. So I think the independent world has always been sort of the home of alternative ideas and alternative music. And often that throws in pop bands because sometimes alternative ideas become very popular.
Yeah, sure.
So, but yeah, it's quite, our indie.
It's quite interesting how there are, exactly as you say, there are certain pop acts. I mean, the obvious one is Adele, who was on an indie label until very recently.
The same with Ed Sheeran as well, was on an indie until they folded into Atlantic or whatever.
Yeah. And I mean, it does foster this kind of slightly experimental take on sometimes something very mainstream. You know, I'm thinking about Self Esteem at the moment, who's on an indie, and she's doing essentially similar sound palette to quite a lot of the pop acts, but it's got this alternative lean to it.
Yeah.
And so it's a sort of natural home. But Ninja Tune, for my money, it's a very special independent label because, well, for numerous reasons, but one of the things that really hit home to me back in the early days was the reach.
Yeah.
The fact that it had this global reach.
Well, that was carved out the hard way by Ninja, and that all comes from the DJ days.
Yeah.
That all comes from DJs going out to different territories and Cold Cut and Ninja Tune, you know, finding a partner in Belgium and finding a partner in Russia and finding partners in Australia where that network didn't exist in the past. So if you were on Sony or you know, Universal, you had an office everywhere. But if you're on an indie, you were completely trapped in the ghetto of wherever your indie was based, like London or Paris or Barcelona or whatever. But Ninja Tune, through the DJing bookings, because when I started DJing, I didn't have an agent, didn't have a mobile number, didn't have an email address. So you'd just call Ninja Tune to book me to DJ.
Mm.
And they'd be like, yeah, here's his number, mate. Give him a call. And so that network, that global network, was kind of carved out piece by piece, country by country, just simply by sending DJs over there, meeting promoters. Promoters would lead to labels, distribution deals, and so on. And Ninja kind of built their own, Ninja and Warp kind of simultaneously built their own global reach, kind of piece by piece, you know, literally piece by piece. And yeah, because we talked in the early days when we were doing the Biscuits for Breakfast era about how, when we put this record out, it will come out everywhere.
Yeah.
At the same time, which for touring can be quite difficult because you can't be everywhere at the same week. You can't be in LA, New York, Paris, London, Moscow, and Sydney in the same week. So it gives you a good problem of, okay, everybody's heard the record everywhere. And the and the great thing is you might work in a country that you've never would have imagined. We might have been big in Argentina or huge in Australia. You just don't know who's going to get it the most.
Definitely.
Another thing that's just really great about Ninja Tune as an independent entity is it's one of these, I mean, it sounds like such a cliche, but it's an artist's label owned by artists set up for independent artists with their own cash. Cold, the story is, you know, Cold Cut, who own Ninja, and still, you know, own Ninja, obviously. They were like a really big 80s pop, early 90s pop force. They produced big pop records, like totally by accident, you know, for some massive...
The Only Way Is Up.
The Only Way Is Up is okay, the you know, the albatross around their neck. But, you know, they were producing this sound which came from the kind of London pirate radio sort of early DJ scene. And, they signed to a major. There's no shame in it. They signed a huge monster deal with a major where the cigar-chomping CEO was like, you guys are the future. Oh, my God, you're going to produce the biggest... You're going to be the new, you know, Tony Visconti or whatever. And then their CEO, I think the story goes that the CEO that signed them that thought they were great then left. And the new CEO hated this modern sort of sound and wanted rock bands. So Cold Cut got out of their deal. They got to keep the advance. They got to get their masters back. And with the advance money, they set up Ninja Tune and signed their mates. And their mates were good. So, and you know, our CEO, Peter, who we've had the whole time, he was one of their friends that they said, oh, dude, you know, we're kind of running out of bandwidth. Can you, you know, deal with this record label thing? And now he's like, you know, one of the most powerful independent voices in modern music, which is awesome. So, yeah, it means that the artists on Ninja, they don't do moany artists. They don't really do, oh, it's so unfair, the label don't do anything for me artists. They want you to work hard because they come from that hardworking ethos.
I think you're spot on, Finn, actually. And I think with Ninja Tune, one of the things is... the reputation was founded on really good quality control, I think, because I, at that point in time, didn't know much about that area of music, that genre of music. But even I knew of Ninja Tune. They stood out from the crowd pretty early on. I mean, there's a lot of labels all trying to do similar things at the same time in terms of, you know, the sonics and the vibe that followed in the slipstream, if you like. But yeah, would you say quality control was the secret to their success? Where others, there's a lot of rubbish.
I think some of it is like creating a genre, and therefore only you can service that genre because it's your genre. So there's that. There's also branding and marketing, which is kind of accidental, but they happen to have a really cool name and an amazingly cool logo, which kind of helped as well for people to, you know, buy the T-shirt as well as buy the record. And as Timmy says in the book, you know, people would go to a DJ gig to see the DJ, even if they'd never heard of the DJ, just because it would say brackets Ninja Tune brackets after the name. So you kind of knew what you were going to get. But also just the fact that they really wanted to put music out. They wanted to release records and albums from artists, you know, in a scene that wasn't really into albums. It was all about 12 inches and dance singles, and they were quite into the concept of albums and letting their artists sort of giving their artists freedom, not giving them a lot of money, but giving them the freedom to go make a record. If it's really good, we'll put it out and it'll come out everywhere and you'll DJ everywhere. And
that was our
indie life. But a lot of independent labels, they run on a very, very tight margin. So you might think that there's a sense that there's a bit of risk aversity in the independent sector, because if you get it wrong, it's your own money that you lose as a label. But I think the independent sector worked out pretty early that safety is kind of the least safe place to be. And sure. the more edgy you are, the more likely you are to survive.
Yeah.
At a time when the majors, obviously, major labels are much bigger. It's like a giant oil tanker. It's very difficult to turn. It's very difficult to move and make quick moves. Whereas indies can do that week by week. They can change their identity or sign a band and put it out in a few weeks. They're very lean. So I think there was a couple of years there where the independent sector, at least recently, managed to roll with the punches and adapt to streaming and technology and all the new hurdles we have to jump over, where the majors took along. I mean, the majors' answer is, oh, we'll just buy the platform, or we'll just invent a new format, or we'll reissue kind of Blue by Miles Davis for the 25th time because we found an outtake and a photo that you haven't seen before, kind of thing. Whereas the indies are like, well, while you're doing that, we're going to reinvent punk. Or while you're doing that, we're going to try a new take on alternative baggy psych or whatever the niche. I wish that would be a thing. Alternative baggy psych. Come on, everybody. Nice. Let's make that happen, yeah?
Alternative baggy psych. Yeah,
baggy needs to come back. Isn't that spiritualized? Exactly. I mean, we need baggy back in our lives. And I can't believe it hasn't been done yet. So come on, kids.
Interesting.
Baggy. You know,
maybe that's for think album eight or album nine, or whatever. Baggy.
I don't want a bunch of old guys to do it.
Yeah, baggy will be along shortly. It'll be back on the everything comes back eventually cycle. But it's funny. I think risk aversion. It's funny you should say risk aversion because I think you're right, but it's a double edged sword again. Because I reckon the fact that the indies, they don't splurge tons of money at the outset in a excitable fit of promoing someone new means that you've got more chance of having another swing at a bat if the first one doesn't land you a massive top 10 hit as everybody dreams it will. Whereas a major, they'll insist on, they're just going to spend a fucking shit ton of cash.
Yeah.
And then as a result, if it doesn't then land exactly how everybody wants, they'll immediately wash their hands of the artist in question and probably keep them on a, you know, 360 deal for forever.
Well, whereas
you were never going to see that on the indies.
I mean, I saw this all the time in the majors when I was in the 90s, the whole double or quits conversation. It happened a lot. You know, the first album would cost, let's say, £1 million. And then they're like, okay, it didn't quite make £1 million. Are we going to do another one? It's like, okay, well, it's double or quits really, isn't it? The next album's going to cost another £1 million. We got to do 2 million units to make break even. And this is the thing with the indies. The bands and the artists in the indie sector are kind of freer because our benchmark is break even. It's just like zero is our benchmark.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
If we can make it to zero, which we talk about a lot in the book, it took us 3 albums to get to zero. But you know, if you can survive on that margin, then and you're on a good indie, then it's in the indie's interest to just be like, yeah, just keep putting records out. You know, it makes the catalog worth something. You get to tour. You never know what's going to happen. And, you know, even, I mean, we've used this guy as an example a lot, but Jose Gonzalez was on an indie and he was on, and he was very inspirational to me. His new record, Local Valley, by the way, is just really special. But he was on an indie as well. And I just think, I mean, the indies have always been there. I mean, the 80s indie scene was obviously the punk indie scene, and the word indie as to describe a genre of music comes from so many fantastic labels in the 80s. I mean, although there was that moment in the NME independent music charts where it got very wonky because Stock Aitken and Waterman counted as an indie label as well, which of course they were, which is completely fair enough. But you know, Kylie and Jason, especially for you, doesn't really strike me as an indie record.
No.
What was that gingerhead girl what was she called?
Sonia,
that's where they were like, we're going to make a hit record with someone that's got no talent and here we go. And they're like, this isn't indie,
sure.
Or Kylie, you know, it's like, ugh. But it was indie, that's the thing. You know,
I wonder if that may have precipitated the... Because indie sort of collapsed a bit in the 90s, didn't it? It kind of... That idea of there being lots of different indie labels doing lots of different artists, which there was in the 80s, that kind of collapsed in the 90s and then it came back in the 2000s with Domino. And then it suddenly all kicked off again.
Well, some of the indies... I would argue, just off the top of my head, I would say, well, the problem with the 90s is that a lot of talent got persuaded to join the dark side of dance music, because a lot of talent in the 90s became dance music.
Right.
Whereas if dance music had not happened in a parallel universe, they would all be in indie bands. But they became, you know, producers and jungle and DJs, and all that stuff's kind of sucked a lot of the young talent in the UK out of indie and into dance music. And it's easy to forget how euphoric the 90s kind of was when it comes to like, ah, everything's so new, everything's so exciting, everything's so different. And then you think, those kids who like the Smiths, you're like, yeah, that isn't very exciting or different or new. Or even though that's quite an ignorant thing to think, because obviously they are. But I think that the 90s was a time of this kind of euphoric experimentation. I don't think indie really does. Classic indie music doesn't really do euphoric.
Well, indie went to its own version of the dark side as well because of Britpop, and Britpop is the sort of moment where, I mean, I know it's a cliche to say, but it's the moment where indie went super mainstream to the point. I mean, you know, the weird thing about Britpop is the almost all the major players of Britpop were on majors, so it wasn't an indie movement at all.
Yeah,
it was, you know, Blur were on EMI, Oasis were on Sony, Pulp were on, I can't remember, you know, but it was all very major driven. So I think that's where it all got buried.
Well, I think I saw this documentary on Netflix about Britpop recently, and it had all these Britpop bands just saying, you know, you did a gig in the Dublin Castle and you were signed. It was just everybody with a pulse was just getting signed.
Yes.
Just everybody, anyone that played anywhere in Camden was just getting signed immediately.
Yeah.
And then
you had Prankster showing up 2 years later and never missing the boat.
But they must have just been nervous of missing anything then at that point. That must have been the reason.
Oh, sure. Well, Menswear is the big one. They got signed after like 3 gigs. And they had so much action that... there were so many record companies wanting to sign them that in the end, their choice of who to go with came down to the fact that Jeff Travis from Rough Trade made them pay for their own pizza. And they thought, fuck.
Well, and they liked that.
No, they didn't. They thought, fuck that. If you can't be bothered to buy us a pizza, let's sign to someone else instead.
They should have signed to Rough Trade. What a fantastic label that is. I mean, what, talking of indie, I mean, Rough Trade is pretty much the godfather of indie, isn't
exactly,
it? Really?
Exactly. But I have a question for you, both of you, but imagine if... Because I think about the majors and Fink's relationship with a major sometimes. What if, after sort of Revolution, some major sweet-talked Summit into...
They nearly did.
Right. But imagine if we'd done that and we'd gone, okay.
Imagine if we'd signed to Starbucks. They were that was the label that was courting us at the time.
Oh, my God.
Do you remember
that? Perfect Darkness... I don't.
Well, I mean, you remember Starbucks started a label...
Yeah, I can't remember what it was called. And something. Paul McCartney's album came out on it.
Exactly. So they signed Joni Mitchell, Paul McCartney. You know, they just went on a binge and signed whoever.
It was called something really crap, like Choice Music or something.
Yeah, no, I don't know, Matt. I mean, don't get me wrong. I do love my Starbucks, as you know. And I did kind of think, that's interesting, because then our record... Because at the time, record stores were getting closed everywhere.
That's
and
true,
everyone was screaming about how... the physical format was going to die and vinyl was going to die and iTunes is the new record label and downloads is the future of music. And we thought, well, yeah, if we can have our CD in every Starbucks in the world, then that pre-order is going to be pretty chunky. And,
you know,
how does that conversation
It was
go?
Called Hear Music, by the way.
What was that? Tia?
Congratulations.
Hear Music.
I wish I was the consultant that got paid millions to come up with that.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Just like, okay, guys, I got it. Music, you hear it. So we're going to call it Hear Music.
But I do remember this, mate. You're right. Because wasn't it... the problem that we had with the idea was it meant that our record would literally just be sat there pretty lonely at the time, surrounded by sort of, you know, mixed CDs of chilled out Brazilian...
It was essentially the forerunner of the Spotify playlist. It essentially was.
Yeah.
It's like the Sunday coffee brunch playlist. Or the, as you say, bro, Brazilian Latin jazz that sounds nice with a cappuccino playlist sort of stuff. And yes, it would have been a disaster. And I'm so glad that Summit had the balls of steel to say, I don't think you should do this. Because obviously at the time I was kind of like, dude, I need to buy, you know, a new wing mirror for my car. Let's do this deal. But you know what I mean?
But in Tim's hypothetical world, if it was someone else,
like a more conventional major.
Yeah, I think I don't know, mate. It's tough to say, isn't it?
Because Perfect Darkness. I mean, that would be the
At the time, I might have thought maybe it was a brilliant idea. But you know, now obviously looking back, God, hell no! I'm so pleased we didn't.
But this is, I mean, we'll never know if we'd assigned to Blue Note or something. Who knows? You know, or we'd assigned to if let's say Fiction had said to us, oh, we think you're really great. You know, do you want to sign to Fiction? We'd have looked at the back catalogue and said, oh my God, The Cure, we love your record label. We're definitely going to sign. But I think the one thing that the majors offer you, we didn't actually need, which was, we already had distribution, freedom, great A&R, our own sort of direction, and we didn't really need a big check. Not that anyone was offering us one, by the way.
Yeah,
but,
yeah, right.
I don't think giving Fink £500,000 would have made the record any different or changed the trajectory of the band in any way at all. It would have just changed the fact that we wouldn't have been able to put out an album every year or experimented with things like horizontalism, or, you know, it would have been more pressurized. And I don't think we work well as a band under pressure, as I think some of the subsequent records from outside the remit of this book have maybe proved.
True,
that
man.
when we're in an expensive pressure environment, we're not actually at our best, I don't think.
Right.
Yeah.
Just, interesting.
Just more constraint.
Still, it would have been a nice problem to have.
Nice option for a problem to have. But what about you, Mr. T? The poser of the question, what about yourself? What do you think?
Well, I remember at the time, I mean, not that I had to ponder it as a sort of option, but I remember thinking, wow, if we were on a major, we would probably be under considerable pressure to say yes to everything.
Yeah.
And that would include, you know, tours that we didn't think would make any money, and sort of promo that was just sort of, you know, that we would ordinarily kind of think, oh, is that not really worth doing? So I'd be kind of worried about, the cliche is working for the man and kind of having to do a load of shit that we sort of didn't really believe in.
Yeah, I mean, I remember even as a kid, I remember watching a Good Morning TV one morning before I went to school or something. And they had that habit of having a live band on, didn't they? Like on a Friday or something at like 7:30. And even then I thought, oh, dude, that looks rubbish. I mean, those guys look like they really don't want to be there.
I've seen a few things like that. I remember one of my favorite ones was Dodgy. Do you remember the indie band Dodgy?
Sure.
They supported Simply Red at Wembley Stadium. And I was like, dude, come on.
I mean, I think those rules have changed a bit. I saw The Strokes doing a gig, a New Year's Eve gig in New York, and they've got Idols and Heinz on support. And you think, wow, those two bands, they're nothing like The Strokes. Their fan base is nothing like The Strokes, but it's still a gig that's going to be a great gig to do. Yeah, I mean, I think I'm really glad we didn't, because then we wouldn't have had the visceral and real experience that we had. And this first 10 years of Fink, which this IRUII concept kind of covers, definitely wouldn't have happened had we been signed to a different record company. I mean, we were definitely given the bandwidth and the freedom to do whatever we wanted within the constraints of, we are trying to recoup here, not just the band, but also the label. So how much do we think you need for your advance for your record? We can give you $5,000. We think $5,000 is enough. We think you're going to sell 5,000 copies, so we'll give you $5,000. And somehow you've got to make a record within that framework. And I think it's kind of awesome, because it means you've got to have really good ideas as opposed to really good studio or a really good producer or a really good, you know, I'm going to buy a really good guitar. It's more like, how many ideas have you got?
And then we can do something like horizontalism. Like, it's a sort of idea that you had. It's an idea that you made on the road.
Yeah.
And we kind of put the package together on the road.
We absolutely did, like almost literally.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird to think about it, but that album was almost entirely created on the road.
Absolutely, yeah. It was created in the back of Splitter Vans on the American tour, pretty much, most of it.
Mm, Yeah. Even worse. I mean, it's not even in a bus.
True that, yeah. I mean, I'd moved to Berlin 2015, and that was definitely soaking in and getting under my skin a little bit. And I wanted to do a remix. I think it was Ninja's idea or something, or someone's idea. You should do a remix album. Everybody was doing it at the time. And problem with remix albums is you ask your friends to do remixes, and if they suck, either you put them out and you've just put out a sucky record, or you say to your friends, I'm sorry, we're not going to put the remix out, and you lose your friends over it. So I'm like, you know, this remix album thing is I don't really like it. It's a bit of a bed of thorns. I don't really want to do it. So I was really inspired by Massive Attack's No Protection album, where Massive Attack gave Mad Professor the whole record and said, you just remix the whole album. And it's brilliant. It's one of my favorite moments in Massive Attack's discog. Yeah. So, and I thought, well, I'll do that then, because then at least I'm going to like it. And in that process, I went to Berghain for the first time. And first time I didn't get in, fair enough. Second time I made sure I was on the guest list and everything. I definitely got in. And I had the most amazing clubbing experience. One of the best clubbing experiences of my life. And it was amazing. It was completely fantastic. One of the most greatest experiences I've ever had in Clubland. And so I came home and I wrote Fall Into the Light. Obviously, I was awake for a couple of days after that experience. Yeah. So I could have plenty of time to write Fall Into the Light.
Yeah.
And, so the Horizontalism album was a remix album of Hard Believer, with a lot of Berlin sort of dereliction and, you know, this kind of stuff. Yeah. But it also had two really, really beautiful songs on it. Fall Into the Light, which we ended up touring at the end of this book. And there was one other really lovely track on it. What's it called, man?
First song on side two.
Yeah, I can't remember what it is
it
now.
It starts
but it's
with
lush.
A. Yeah, I can pick.
Yeah, ding, 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 ding. Yes, yeah, it's just got it's a lovely vibe on it. And so, Where You Live has a big impact too. And Berlin was definitely getting under my skin at this point. And, you know, so that record is my kind of neon dereliction, wasteland, you know, futuristic Berlin record. Yeah.
It's one of my favorite records, actually, because I can listen to it without, you know, if I listen to Hard Believer or something like that, I'm constantly listening to what we're doing and what I'm doing and
And choices and the choices we made.
Yeah. But Horizontalism, I have a bit of a distance from, you know, although I still, broadly speaking, it's sort of us.
I'm just remembering there's even that this track on it called A38 Breakdown.
Yeah, exactly.
Which was where I was moving all of my gear to my parents' house in Cornwall before I moved to Berlin, and in a Renault Kangoo or something. And you know, and I broke down on the A38, and I was like, oh, this is just so bloody typical of my life right now. It's just all just breaking down.
Yeah.
And I just record while I was waiting for the tow man, I just recorded the traffic going by.
Yeah, it's nice. It's good, that one. By the way, it's called Suffering is the Art of Love.
Suffering is the Art of Love, yes, indeed. Which I actually wrote that for the Red Cross. And then they very kindly let me use it for Horizontalism. But I wrote that as part of a campaign for the Red Cross.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, yeah, because I was suffering at the time, very much suffering very deeply, which is weird because, you know, our career was in this amazing spot that we'd always wanted to get to, which was, you know, we were wanted, we were loved, we were well received, and yet my personal life was just all the wheels were falling off, and everything was just falling apart, and it was a really, really weird year. 2015 was such a bizarre moment. To be really great, career's going amazing, couldn't be better, and on the other hand, yeah, I'm moving to Berlin on my own.
Yeah.
So, you know, work that one out. You know,
it's a
tough one.
It's a terrible thing though, isn't it? Because that is unfortunately the problem with our profession, is that if the better we do, inevitably the more we're going to be away from home.
Yeah, sure.
And, you know, the impact on personal life is, I mean, if 2016 had been like, hey, let's do the same again, but bigger venues. You know, I'm not even sure I'd be still.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But yeah, just going back to Horizontalism. I mean, I do really love that. That for me just encapsulates that whole second leg of the Hard Believer tour, because we were sort of firing on all cylinders. We were able to do stuff while we were on tour, we were playing all these really cool gigs and still able to kind of do all this other business, you know, make that, you know, have this kind of idea at Meat Factory in Prague of writing, hey, let's write the name of the album in gaffer tape on the back of the venue and get RG to photograph it. I mean, that's the kind of idea you can only have on tour. And, you know, it's one of those things that I forget which artist said it, but inspiration has to find you working. I can't remember who said that.
Interesting. Probably Bowie, I'd imagine.
Yeah, the theory being that, you know, you can sit around and wait for inspiration for ages, but it's not going to come. But if you're working, if you're trying to work the whole time, your brain, something about your brain kind of creates these ideas. But it's also a very... it said a lot about the team we were in at that time, you know.
Yeah, true.
Being able to sort of say to RG, can you do this? You know, being able to say to our tour manager, can you, Simon, facilitate this? And all of those things on a day when it's Rob, our sound engineer's birthday, and the venue's got him some prawns for his dinner, you know. It's so nice. That whole package is just so... It's so lovely.
I mean, I think that's why we wanted to do the first 10 years, isn't it? As part of this, it isn't until it is as a 10-year package. Because 10, obviously, you know, we're used to these, you know, decimal sort of situations. But also just like when we finished the Fall Into the Light tour, the end of 2015, we'd done all these massive festivals and really amazing headline shows with a big crew and a big bus, and it was all just working wonderfully. Everything was great. It was just a nice arc to go from us meeting in a pub in 2004 to this moment at the end of that tour in 2015, because none of us would have imagined that when we met in 2004 that it would actually get to that, I'm sure.
No.
I didn't have any idea that that was an option, but
sure,
just that it would actually work out, you know. And and then the future presents itself with a new set of problems, which is, well, do you want to sustain this? Do you want to go bigger? Do you want to shrink? Do you want to, you know, have a whole new set of artistic problems now, because you're not just scrambling up the hill anymore.
Yeah.
You've kind of reached a kind of nice moment on the hill. You kind of look at the view a little bit and go, that's nice up here. I like it. I kind of don't want to go. How do we stay?
Yes.
Or even you go look up further and go, I want to get to up there. How do I get up there?
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And we saw on the way up during this trajectory, we saw other bands. I mean, we saw hundreds of bands come and go, and every backstage at a festival, you know, where there's, you know, 50 bands, you know, we made some friends, and then all of a sudden we didn't see them anymore because they weren't a thing anymore, or we'd make friends with someone, and then a couple of years later they'd be actually getting flown in on a private jet and being shuttled to the main stage, so we didn't really get to say hi anymore. And, you know, we get to see all these different, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
we get to see all these different trajectories of bands and that have come and gone. And somehow we've just managed to, like, during this period of time, this first 10 years, we were always just getting slightly bigger, slightly more stable. Like every time we would put our feet on the ground, make sure the ground was steady before we launched off to the next layer.
Yeah.
So we never actually slipped back. We never sort of, this trajectory is a very nice graph. It just gently goes up and up and up and up and up over a 10-year period, which is a great, great way to sort of round off.
Yeah.
This book, because it was kind of like we had these stupid crazy dreams, not that we knew where they would end, and they ended up actually right in the spot where you kind of dream that they would, which is probably backstage at a festival, having just rocked the main stage and felt great, and you know, having some free beers with your mates.
Pretty much, I mean, just doesn't get much better than that, really, does it?
Can we all pick a gig that you think is sort of like a kind of moment where you think, yeah, that was the one where I think I'm fucking doing it. I'm achieving, you know.
Wow.
And it doesn't have to be a big one. It can be a little one. Just one of, you know, one of your favorite kind of moments.
An achieving gig.
It also has to be within this 10-year period.
This 10-year period. Yeah, I mean, an achieving in a certain way, you know. Doesn't have to be like the biggest crowd or anything. Just
like for me, it would be Rock Werchter, because which is a big ass festival. Where is it? Is it in Belgium?
Belgium, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And the backstage area was very sort of grown up. I mean, you had, was it Muses? Yeah. No, Blur. Muse had their own set of catering, had their own salt cellars and had their own
cutlery. Well, they tried to, didn't they? They put notices up on it saying, this is Muses' toilet, but everyone kind of ignored it, I think.
I think that just makes you want to use it even more, actually. But
exactly.
No, because it'll be nice, right? So, Rockwerchter, backstage was amazing. I didn't expect much from the gig. I was a bit intimidated by the size of the venue and the size of the tent and the size of the stage. But when we got out on that stage, it was just like electric. Everything we did just was awesome. And everybody seemed to really love it in a genuine way. And our running order was perfect and our set was great. And the singles were working. And it was just kind of like at the end of that set, I did kind of feel like a rock star. That or Ziggett. There was a Ziggett gig we did, the one where we met Bonobo backstage and he lost his laptop for a second. And it turns out he'd left it in catering,
That's right.
And his entire show was on this laptop and he was just freaking out. that Ziggett show was also, it's funny that they're both festival shows for me, but just because.
Yeah.
You're just,
was that the first time we did it? Was it that the first Ziggett we did?
It might be the first A38 stage we did at Ziggett, but. Yeah, I think it's either Ziggett or Werchter.
Yeah, Rockwerchter was that was about the size of a sort of Wembley Arena kind of stage. It was about, I was told it was sort of 14,000 people.
Yeah, it was very good. I was going to mention that one,
which is quite incredible.
Okay, well, I'm gonna go next then, Mr. T, if I may, and I'm gonna buck the system and say I'm gonna pick two, and they're festivals as well, and both Lowlands breakfast experiences of us throwing out the brekkie. Those our early morning sets there. The first one was amazing, just as we've described already in his podcast at length in his book, for whatever reason. And then the second one, the odds of it being amazing again, the same slot, the same breakfast thing, we'd built it up in our heads hoping it's going to be as good as the first time, and it was just even better.
Yeah.
There's something about Lowlands, I just love it. And also, I'm going to buck the system even more and just say also every Paradiso show we've ever done, from Yonder Boy, Support, ever on through, up to every time we're there, I want to pinch myself.
Timmy asked you to pick one gig, and you've just picked like 15 gigs.
I know, but
there's
a problem in it.
I get the idea.
I'll just shut up. It's not like anything. It's fine. You're fine. You're right. I bucked the system. I apologize. Okay, I'm just going to pick the two.
Fine.
Just the Lowlands.
Well, I'm gonna buck the system. I'm not going to buck the system. I'm going to actually...
A whole tour. An entire tour.
A lot of bucking going on in this podcast.
I'm going to actually... basically, this is a very strange pick, but we played a venue in Helsinki.
Yeah, okay.
In 2014, I believe.
What was it called? Tavastar, something like that?
It wasn't the slightly bigger one. It was the smaller one, which I can't remember. It's the very first time we played Helsinki, and we'd been on the Love Boat from Stockholm, and we were all,
oh my goodness,
none of us had had really very much sleep. And we arrived at the venue at something stupid like 7:30 a.m. and we were just poured into the venue and we just hung around all morning, just sort of like sleeping a bit and like getting ready for the in-house sound crew to arrive. And it didn't seem like it was going to be a particularly, you know, good gig. But for some weird reason, something to do with the size of the venue, it was very small, and the way it was laid out, and it ended up being a sellout, and we had all five of us, so it was Ruben, Chris, and the three of us. And when we played the gig, it was one of those gigs where the stage was so small that I had to put my drum kit almost at a right angle to everyone else. And I had Karima behind... Oh, Karima was either behind me, our monitor engineer, or she was behind Ruben. Yeah. So consequently, I could see everyone from the stage. I could see all you guys. I could see Karima. I could see Simon hanging around somewhere. I could see Rob very closely. And I could see Argy behind Rob. And it was a sellout, packed venue. And we played a blinder. And it was
nice.
Just like, I remember that just being such an amazing little moment. And I remember you introduced the band and you introduced Ruben. And Ruben did a little kind of jazzy moment on his keyboards. And I accompanied him with a sort of like cod jazz, thing on the drums. And it was just one of those, like, that was a cracking gig. It wasn't big. It wasn't
nice. Wasn't clever.
Wasn't
was that the day? Was I don't remember pouring in there at 7 a.m. Was that the Helsinki gig where I had been away to Denmark for my kid's birthday?
And no, I you were about to go. You're about to go to your kid's birthday.
So this wasn't the one where Simon was so catastrophically hungover.
No,
he had to get woken up. No. Okay, right.
That was the next. That was the next time you played Helsinki. And actually, funnily enough, after that gig, the one I'm describing, we had a two or three day break, in which the bus was going to trundle down to Maastricht to begin the kind of bigger part of the tour. And you,
Archie flew to Amsterdam.
You did.
That's right. You did. You did. You flew to Amsterdam. Yeah. That's just outrageous. Yeah. You know,
while we stayed on the bus and we lost all concept of time because, you know, we had to get on a ferry in the middle of the night. Yeah. Ferry in the middle of the night, couple of ferries. It was just really strange. I remember kind of arriving in Maastricht thinking, I don't even know what time it is. It was like we'd flown to Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, there's if that was the one gig, which is a wonderful, that's a wonderful memory, dude, that finish.
Yeah.
What's the kind of, you know, is there another key moment from this 10-year period where you think, okay, it isn't until it is? Like, it all of a sudden it is.
Yeah.
Is there a key moment for you like that in this period where it's suddenly like, okay, this is now? Like for me, it was, for me, I think just to emphasize it, I would say it's probably when we played in Australia.
Yeah.
We went for breakfast at some trendy breakfast spot and the waitress recognized me and was like, oh yeah, I'm going to come and see you play tomorrow night or something. And then I realized, wow, cause we're on the other side of the fucking world right now.
Yeah,
our music has really traveled. Like, wow, that really blew my mind. That's when I thought, okay,
yeah,
Fink's a thing. You know, it's bigger than me actually now.
Yeah, I know. That's crazy, isn't it? That was. I mean, the one that springs to mind now, you said that is actually the first time we played Moscow.
Right.
So, which actually I'm cheating because it wasn't in this time period, but we'd never played there before. We'd never set foot in Russia as a band, and there were people with
placards,
you know, holding up banners and t-shirts and stuff, and the weird thing was we arrived the day before and we were wandering around Moscow and we just saw, you know, various people, but I didn't see any kind of sort of indie kind of Fink.
No, I just remember at the hotel just seeing kind of women in fur coats, like classic, you know, Moscow cliches. But I just remember thinking, who's going to come to our show?
Who's going to come to our show?
Looks like millionaires.
I know. And then the doors opened, and all the usual kind of, you know, people that we'd see at a gig in wherever came through the door. And I was like, where have you guys been hiding in the last 2 days? You know,
that was a great venue, wasn't it? Really destroyed, really cool old school venue. That was really fantastic.
And there were some people we met I think we went for a coffee around the corner before the show. And some people had traveled from beyond the Ural Mountains to see us. Right. And that is a long journey. That was like 16 hours on a train or something crazy.
And some of those folks helped us out after the gig. It was very much disco loadout. And we were lugging loads of our stuff into a van and then onto a train station. And there were some mishaps whereby we needed to have a little bit of liquid Russian cash, which we didn't have at the time. And if I recall correctly, a group of guys who had just come along to see the gig helped us
friends
out
of the promoter.
They literally just stuck around, carried all our stuff like Sherpas, and even paid any small fees that needed paying for us. Honestly, loveliest. I loved it. I thought it was amazing, man. Best experience. You're right. Russia was great.
Really, what about really you, cool. Guy? Have you got a it isn't until it is moment?
You know, actually, it just focused my mind when you asked that question. And you know what? I retract all my previous. I can definitely say it was the second. It was the second Lowlands, and part of the reason why was that some friends of ours were in the audience who've known us in Holland for years and years and years. Elena and BB, maybe Natalie was there, or those guys. That group were there, and they'd seen us do a lot of these shows before. They'd seen us go from doing the tiniest venues to where we were now, and you know me, I'm a bit self-deprecating, aren't I, lads? I tend to look at things a bit, I'm a glass half empty, like to keep myself in a pretty miserable negative mindset most of the time. So I don't really take compliments very easily and stuff. And it hadn't really sunk in, the scale of that second one. I mean, the first one was big and busy, but the second one was just ridiculous in terms of the number of people who showed up. Looking Too Closely had just been slam dunking it on the radio all over the place and knew it would be silly. But it was our reaction from our friends who had taken pictures at the back of the audience. And I remember our mate saying to me, did you not see? Good God, Fink. I mean, from that to this, it's just jaw-dropping. It's ridiculous. And I hadn't really had it sink in until someone who unarguably had witnessed us go in all the way from 2006 to now had the opportunity to view it through their lens, and literally in one case actually through their lens, and show me the photo and go, look, just behold the sheer success of it all. And that was a bit of a... I couldn't deny it to myself. There it was. And That was a very, very good moment, I remember thinking.
I mean, our gigography at the back of this book, it is pretty jaw-dropping when you put all the dates down, isn't it? And you kind of go, bloody hell, we did practically play bloody everywhere there is to play over this period of time. I mean, if you liked us even vaguely, we would have been in a town near you at some point, you know? Yeah, I mean, it's just crazy. You know, it's really bonkers that we can have this, you know, 500, 600 dates or whatever, and we still remember something from each date to put in the book, like some detail about the rider or about the stage or about you know, Tim banging his head or you know, guy getting some Jean or whatever we remember. It's crazy, isn't it?
I'm so pleased we did that, because we started doing that, I think in 2010, we started doing it in a splitter. We were just writing.
You started doing it, Tim. Take the credit. It was you. And you rightly pointed out we'd lose all these memories otherwise.
True. What happened was MySpace used to have a feature where you could kind of download all the gigs in your history that you've done. Right. And then I just pasted them into an Excel thing, and there we went from there.
Yeah.
So yeah, some of the ones were actually recorded at the time, and I think you can spot the ones that were recorded at the time, because you know, you can tell I'm sort of taking dictation a little bit from you guys. And then some of them are recorded long after the event. But it's a real, like, I'm very proud of it. I think we did good to sort of keep it up.
I mean, often I would need a prompt from you, Mr. T, as Guy certainly would as well. Like, Tim, I don't remember this gig at all. Give me something. And Tim would be like, Red Door, backstage, no orange juice. You'd be like, oh yeah, God, I remember that. Yeah, the Red Door, and you know, it was just crazy. And you need a prompt, like, big tree, no lunch, late loading. Oh yeah, I remember that tree. Oh my God, it really freaks me out that all of these essentially useless and pointless memories are stored somewhere in our minds, and there's no way of emptying the trash, seemingly.
No, I know, it's really strange.
Despite my best efforts over this period to you know, relentlessly empty my trash of my brain cells, but I seem to have a pretty good memory.
It's very well worth doing, I think, though, because eventually I think that I found when we went on tour that even in the space of a 2 month run, you try and think back to what gig was which, and they can blur into a bit of a mush if you're not careful.
Yeah, a bit of a paste. Yeah,
you can forget which one was which, and that seems a terrible waste to me. So if you guys remember, before everything was done, itineraries on tour was done on your phones, when it was actual paper still, I always used to write little comments down about what had happened that day in my book, just so I'd remember what had happened. So this gigography is just a much better extension of that concept.
And yeah.
Yeah, I'm so pleased you did it. Even if it didn't interest another soul in the world, just for our sake, just to remember what we've done all this time, it was so valuable. And as it turns out, it does interest other souls in the world. People think, kind of finding that quite funny. So man,
I mean, it's kind of weird, man, because when I was a DJ in the 90s, I kept a diary for a couple of years, and it was and I thought, this is going to be so boring because it's just the same shit. Every entry is like, got on the plane, checked in, you know,
sure,
blah, 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 chatted up the girl next to me or didn't or whatever, and then got to the gig and then did a gig and then, you know, and it was just the same. It was like Groundhog Day. But reading back on these old diaries, it's not like Groundhog Day. There are some tiny details in there which are just like, oh, my God, that happened. I remember that. And
it's the little details, isn't it? It's definitely. The one regret, though, I mean, this is impossible to regret. It's because, you know, at the end of the day, it happens. It's our experience. But there are certain gigs where I've just said something random, like the gig was, you know, inconsequential or something. And I worry sometimes about people who've been to that gig and they actually thought, oh, I went to that Fink gig in Dresden.
Yeah.
That was amazing. I really loved that night. And then they look at the gigography and they think there's me just going, oh, yeah, it was inconsequential.
Yeah, but also bear in mind, conversely, for every one of those, Mr. T, there'll be someone out there, exactly, you know where I'm going, who on one, you've written, it was the most amazing, we were great, man. That Helsinki one you just mentioned. You're like, it was amazing. Someone out there thinks, what a load of old shit.
Yeah.
They were so bollocks. So the universe will balance itself out.
You'd be a member of the bar staff because often, you know, they see, as Timmy, from your old days, you used to work at Shepherd's Bush, so you're one of those jaded, hackneyed bar staff type people. I've seen it all. God, I've seen Mick Jagger soundcheck, man. You know, God, I'm so over this. And it's those people. Yeah. So when the staff, after the show, I guess more in the old days than now or at the end of the book, you know, where after the show, you might go to the bar and just beg the staff, can you just give me a draft beer? Because, you know, just everyone's clearing up. And they're, just give me a pression. I just want to hang here and just be normal for a second while everyone's just clearing up. And then sometimes they would say, you know, very rarely they would say, oh, man, loved your show. It was really great. Wow, I really liked it or whatever. Most of the time they would just begrudgingly hand you a plastic cup with lukewarm pression in it and just be like, God, boring. But when, like, just like that Rotown Fest, that early Motor Mosaic Festival we did, where the film crew was like, you were really good, and we were all kind of like, oh my God, that means we must have been really good. It's that means a lot to me when the bar staff,
they don't fake sincerity. You know? Yeah, they don't fake sincerity.
Don't have to, man.
Exactly.
Yeah, they don't need to. Exactly.
You are every cliche in the world already, and they've already seen it 1,000 times. They've already seen it 7 times already that week. So
that week,
literally.
Sure.
Precisely. They're so bored of it when you're showing off in soundcheck, doing your little fills, thinking you're impressing everybody.
So.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of it,
that,
guys.
That is kind of it. I'm just going to look at the book.
Yeah.
Gosh, it's beautiful, isn't it? And just look at the back and just see what the last thing we wrote was. Yeah.
Oh, the last thing in chapter 8.
No, the last gig in the gigography.
I remember what it was, I think.
Tanzbrunnen in Cologne, 16th of November, 2015. Sean joined us on wheels.
That's right.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
We were on the bill with She Drunk the Rider, which is nice. She drew the gun.
Very good.
And Guy says, on the observations, massively vibey.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Perfect last show of the tour. And then FG says, I have no memory of this show or how I got back to Berlin.
See, it's gold.
I can remember sitting in a very rainy bus the following day, ready to go back. And that's actually always a really depressing moment. Even though you're going home, there's something really depressing about going to the airport at the end of a tour.
Oh, fuck.
There is, you know, because we should maybe just touch on this beautiful moment of sadness, because often with a Fink tour, you have to say goodbye at an airport. The bus is dropping you off before the bus trundles back to the bus depot, and we're all going to fly to wherever the hub is, and then we're all going to break away from there. And it is really sad when you get your gear out of the bus and then you go into the airport and realizing, we're not going to be with each other for we don't know when we're next going to see each other, you know.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, what an experience. No more gigs. Yeah. It's really sad. Yeah,
and I've spent the previous three weeks picturing a real tearful goodbye with Frank, the bus driver. And then all he does is literally just turn around and go, bye, and walk away. And you're like, shit.
Drops you off.
Turns out he never loved me at all.
No, true that. He just stops outside the airport, empties the toilet, and then just drives off. Like, yeah, thanks. one time I went back with the bus to the bus guys. I went back to the depot with Simon. Yeah, I went back with Simon to pay the bill in cash out of the merch money.
Did you?
Yeah, and it was epic, man, because, you know, as boys, you know, they buy these buses and then they make the bus inside themselves. So they buy it like they don't buy them already made. You buy it as a bus and then you empty it and then you put beds in there and a kitchen in there and a lounge in there. And each section of the bus thing has like, these are the bed guys, these are the kitchen guys, these are the leather upholstery guys, this is the PlayStation section. It's just so amazing to see as a boy. You're just like, I want to work here. I wish I worked here. This is the coolest job ever. And then we go into the office and, you know, we have to pay a 4-month run of a double decker nightliner in cash. It's a lot of cash. And
wow.
And Marco's there, you know, like counting it, you know, on the table. And it was just kind of like, that was a really great way to end the tour, because it was like, blimey, that's money that we've earned selling t-shirts. That we those are tees and vinyl and records, and fans have bought this and we're paying it for the bus here. And it was just mega. Really mega.
It's really nice having something to do immediately afterwards, actually. Like there's something in that Bono, I heard, you know, checks into a hotel in Dublin for a couple of days after each tour.
It's probably his own hotel, but
probably is, yeah, but to sort of decompress.
I read that Tom York does the same thing. I don't know if he does or not, maybe it's bullshit, but I heard that after these big tours he just goes somewhere for a week and just to kind of, and I totally get this, and all of our wives have probably would wish we would do the same thing, but it's just kind of like just to reconnect and re-engage with the person you are, who isn't in a band and isn't doing gigs and is just like normal, and, you know, just a normal person, because you're not a normal person.
No, if you're not in a band, even though you think you might be. I mean, you know, the times I've come home and just strode into the flat and be like, hey, I'm here, you know, and it's like, you think you're normal, but in fact you're probably really annoying.
no doubt. One of our crew does it. One of our crew always goes home and spends one day at least in a beautiful city, in a beautiful city en route on the way back home, just to decompress from tour. You know what? Exactly. Just exactly as you described, Finn. Just shake off some of that weirdness and just get a little perspective on. You know, honestly, we joke about it being sad, the bus driving away, but it honestly, you do get institutionalized. That's your little home. There's some places, some gigs where. Festivals where there's no real backstage privacy, there's no peace and quiet. The only peace and quiet you're going to find is in that little dark coffin of your bunk. You can draw the curtain, and that's your little zone. And it's
even after years, you can eat your little chalky stash to yourself, guy. That you stashed away that you don't share.
Yes, you can.
Chocolate buttons, bro. Without guilt-free. Sharing any.
Don't even feel guilty. Don't even feel guilty.
Outrage.
But it is genuinely tinged with a bit of sadness, and it's tough saying goodbye to all the guys you've been on tour with as well. All at once, one morning, everyone just suddenly at an airport, boom, just. Scatters apart, and that's it. So a day to yourself is a really, really good idea. Otherwise, you come home and your wife looks at you like you're mad.
I mean, I think the great thing about a tour is that you don't know, and we always have this like little chat at the end of like, what was the best gig? What was the worst gig? What was the funniest moment? What was the stupidest moment? And we've always done that. But you don't actually know what the best gig or the best moment is going to be until the end, the last minute of the last gig, because any gig can be the best gig. It can just turn on a dime like so easily. And it's just like with singles and focus tracks on albums. It's probably not going to be the gig that you thought it was going to be on that tour. Where you go, that's going to be the best one. Oh my God, it's amazing there. It will be the gig in Finland or the gig in Zagreb or something. It'll be something random where... you gel together as a team and you survive an experience, actually thrive in a moment where you're just trying to survive, but actually it turns out to be great, you know?
Well, we've got all this to look forward to next year.
Ah, good times, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
COVID and Brexit allowing. It'll happen.
We'll be touring in a town near you.
Yes, indeed.
As long as you're in Europe.
Yeah, or Russia.
Yeah. Russia's in Europe, bro.
That's a flexible sort of debate, isn't it? I mean,
it depends
where we're going. We are going to Russia. We're going everywhere, but like we normally do. But one of the points of this, it isn't until it is whole book, vinyl, podcast, audiobook, CD situation. was to also run it into a tour as well. So we're stripping back to the original trio, which is us three, and you know, sitting down and going into a bunch of smaller venues that we haven't played in a long time, and you know, playing the record. So we're going to be playing Pills, we're going to be playing Blueberry Pancakes, we're going to be playing, you know, the golden oldies.
So exciting.
It is exciting, isn't it? I mean, there's some fucking cracking venues on this tour that I can't wait to play. So the tour will end up being, you know, another format of this. This It Isn't Until It Is sort of retrospective, isn't it?
Yes, really? yes, exactly. Guy's got his acoustic bass out. I can
there
report.
There it is.
Oh, I can't wait to get out on tour and play this motherfucker.
Nice, fretless fun.
Well, on that note.
I love that. Literally, on that note, on that note. Very good, very good. Podcast gold from Tim Thornton.
Well, we should say thank you to everyone who's listened to all 9 episodes, or even if you've just listened to a couple of them.
Yeah, thanks for listening. And, you know, we'll probably do more because I've actually enjoyed hanging out with you guys and doing this and talking rubbish.
Absolutely.
We need to just, maybe we'll ask Tim, like we normally do, to come up with the concept, arrange it all, tell us when we're going to do it, and then we'll do it.
Maybe we can do some on tour.
Well,
we might be able to do an episode or two.
You know what
tour.
Guys like on tour? It'd be like pulling teeth. It'd be like, dude, we're going to do a podcast. Oh, God. Couldn't think of anything worse. Jesus Christ. I'm going to go and have lunch. Bye.
Yeah, that's true. Yes. Well, we'll see.
Maybe we'll do it on tour, Timmy. Yeah.
Good idea. Anyway,
I'll drop my bits in later. I'll just literally... dump myself in over the top, interjecting. That's a lie. That's untrue. That's bullshit.
I concur.
Yeah. Excellent.
All right. Nice. Well, then bye. See
you. Nice one, guys. Let's stop recording.
Yeah, stop recording. Yes. Bless you.
Stop recording.